The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The Soul of Democracy and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Carlyle, the man of letters, as prophet and interpreter. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, Thomas Carlyle was the chief medium through which those streams of European thought that vitalized the 19th century entered the English-speaking world. Writer of moving prose poetry, deep in moral insight, he is a high example of the man of letters as interpreter of life. The political and social idealism of the French Revolution sifted into England through her literature. Cowper and Burns indicated what was coming. Shelley and Byron are poets of revolution. Even Wordsworth, conservative as he became in age, dreamed in his youth of joining one of the revolutionary parties in France. Just as this influence was liberalizing England, the second stream entered, the new German literature and philosophy, more akin to the English spirit. Its inspiration began with Immanuel Kant, whose ethical philosophy gave back, through the idea of duty, the God, immortality, and freedom he had held beyond proof. In a new sense, he made man what Carlyle calls the true Shekinah and revelation of the Most High. This challenging philosophy met the new awakening spirit of Germany, and the result was the brilliant period of literature led by Goethe and Schiller. Carlyle is the supreme expression to the English-speaking world of these two streams of European thought, since he is the historian, or rather the epic poet, of the French Revolution and the Columbus of the then undiscovered continent of German literature and philosophy. Born in 1795 in a village of southern Scotland, Carlyle was of poor but proud family with the intense clannishness of the Scotch. Son of a stern, taciturn father and a tender, pious mother, Carlyle never quite fused the two strands of heredity, now one, now the other, dominating him. At 14, with high hopes, he walked 100 miles across the country to enter Edinburgh University. His disappointment in his teachers is recorded in Sartor Resartus. The one exception among the hide-bound pedants was the professor of mathematics. Carlyle promptly fell in love with the subject and dreamed of becoming a professor in the field. One more illustration that is far more important with whom you study than what you study. One aspect of the university did not disappoint him, the library. He reveled in it, absorbing, we are told, the contents of 4 volumes a day other than novels, showing how genius will find its own. Possibly this experience of Carlyle's led him to remark that the true university of these days is a great collection of books, which may have influenced a later Scotchman in sowing libraries generously over the land. Leaving college, Carlyle taught school to replenish his purse and prepare for the ministry. Already, however, he had come to doubt whether he could honestly wear that garment. He did not easily solve the problem, but went through years of spiritual struggle. Nevertheless, he came to the conclusion finally that he must give up all hope of becoming a clergyman and dedicate himself to the precarious life of an independent literary worker. His first lead came in discovering the then unknown German literature. After writing the life of Schiller, he translated Goethe's Wilhelm Meister. Strange that he chose that book, for Carlyle was a sort of fine flower of Scotch Puritanism, and Goethe was neither a Scotch nor any other kind of Puritan. Yet Carlyle remained convinced that Goethe was the wisest of our time. The explanation is that Goethe was Carlyle's personal emancipator, lifting him from a Scotch English to a cosmopolitan worldview. The 4 volumes of Carlyle's writings interpreting German literature contain few ideas that now seem new, but that is because Carlyle made those ideas part of our intellectual atmosphere, and no one can read the volumes without recognizing the new strong voice that had appeared in English letters. At 31 occurred the most important event in Carlyle's personal life, his marriage. With the vulgarity of partly developed democracy, to which nothing is sacred, far too much has been written of the married life of the Carlyles. Yet to appreciate at once Carlyle's strength and weakness, I must touch upon it reverently. Jane Bailey Welsh was one of the most brilliant intellectual women of her time. When Carlyle met her, she was a sort of gay mockingbird, courted and feared by all the young men about her. Quickly, she became a dove with folded wings in Carlyle's strong hand. Nevertheless, both seem to have questioned the wisdom of marriage. But the drawing together was too strong, and they married. It may have been a mistake. If two persons attempt the difficult task of living together, there must be a large identity of taste, interest, and desire. But the more different two persons are, the more they have to give each other. With the Carlyles, there was great likeness of personality. They had the same intellectual interest, and both had unusual endowment of sharp, sarcastic wit. But they could not rest each other. It is one of the pathetic facts of their life story that they spent all their vacations apart. Moreover, there was no baby hand. Little children are God's missionaries to fallen humanity. With an older person, it is easy to quarrel. The sharp word is spoken, the quick retort given, each is too proud to make the initial apology, and the little rift within the lute spoils all the music of domestic happiness. You cannot do that with a child. The baby hand, soft as the petals of a June rose, smooths the wrinkles of anger from face and brow. The baby smile looks to your face till it wins the answering smile. We can only wonder what the married life of the Carlyles might have been had there been one such missionary. But there was not. Is any wonder these two persons were measurably unhappy, with nobody much to blame? During their years at Craigenputtock Farm, Carlyle brought to birth the most wonderful child of his spirit, Sartor Resartus. It is a strange book. Carlyle chose to put the kernel of his thought in two hard shells, the obscure German philosopher and heavy English editor, both imaginary characters. But the sound thought is well worth the effort to crack the shells. The volume is indeed Carlyle's spiritual autobiography. It tells the story of his Scotch childhood, his awakening to the beauty of nature, the struggle to get underway, his early love affair with Margaret Gordon, the blumine of the book, and his struggle with the religious problem. The book is more than that, Sartor Resartus, the tailor made over. It is the philosophy of clothes. Its central idea is that all we see, hear, and touch is but a garment concealing and revealing the life within. We strip off garment after garment, never reaching the ultimate, but going far enough to realize that the last word of science and the first word of religion is wonder in presence of the infinite mystery of life. Thus, the best of the volume is the rendering into moving prose poetry of the heart of Kant's philosophy. It was 2 years before Sartor Resartus was published as a serial in Fraser's Magazine, 3 more till Emerson published it over here, and 7 years from its completion before it appeared in book form in England through friends guaranteeing the cost. At 39, Carlyle risked moving to London, his home henceforth. As he began writing on the French Revolution, John Stuart Mill, then regarding Carlyle as his master, turned over the material he had collected on the subject. Naturally, Carlyle took the first manuscript volume to Mill for criticism. By accident, it was burned. Carlyle had kept no scrap of notes or manuscript. He tells us he took a bath for 3 weeks in modern novels just to keep from thinking. Then he took up the task again, sheer dead work this time, but done so faithfully that Mrs. Carlyle, who alone had read the destroyed volume, said that the rewritten one was even better. A signal example of Carlyle's loyal fulfillment of his own gospel of work. His French Revolution is less a history than an epic poem on the moving series of events with marvelous dramatic pictures scattered through the pages. During its composition, Carlyle was urged to give courses of lectures. Reluctantly accepting to ease the financial problem, he gave each winter for 4 years a memorable course in London. The first was, characteristically, on German literature. The second, on European literature, was described as covering the whole spiritual history and development of mankind from earliest times to the present, showing that Carlyle now realized his vocation. He saw what we should see, that if the rapidly increasing mass of knowledge is to be of value, there must be in each generation some scholar broad enough to gather the whole and interpret it in terms of the human spirit. Carlyle consciously made that his vocation, becoming, as he designates his hero in Sartor Resartus, Professor of Things in General. The last of the four courses, the only one coming down to us as given, was on heroes and hero worship and the heroic in human history, giving Carlyle's own view of great leaders as molding history. Its beauty of expression and emphasis on the will place it among those literary Bibles so challenging to young people. The publication of the French Revolution ended Carlyle's long struggle with poverty, and though urged to continue lecturing, he refused, saying that it was too much a combination of prophet and play actor to suit him. It was not grinding poverty the Carlyles had suffered, but constantly the menace had been there. Now ease, even affluence, had come. Yet I wonder at times if Carlyle did not need just the challenge of material difficulty. From now on, there is a subtle change in him. He began believing that right is might. He came perilously near concluding that therefore might is right, that whatever is conquered has thereby proved itself to have been right. He continued to do great work, as in Past and Present, Cromwell, and other volumes, but increasingly it seemed necessary for him to see a great man across some centuries to recognize him. The strength and weakness of his later work are alike shown in his History of Frederick the Great. Those brilliantly written volumes show his fidelity as historian, his painstaking and thorough scholarship, but they also evidence his increasing worship of the merely strong man, without asking how he got his power or what cause he serves with it. At 70, Carlyle received his greatest public compliment, being elected Lord Rector of his own University of Edinburgh. It gratified him as meaning that the younger generation in Scotland had at last accepted him. He gave the one address, and before his return, word came of his wife's sudden death while driving in Hyde Park. So the old man went home to the dead body of the comrade of 40 years. Then, with yesterday pitilessly clear in the light of the irrevocable, scourged himself with lashings of remorse, as only a Scotch Puritan can. It is a pity that prosaic biographers have taken those self-scourgings as sober statement of fact. 16 years of lonely life remained, a palsied hand stopped his writing, and the refuge in dictating soon was abandoned. In the late years, he gloomed apart, and only in conversation were there flashes of the old intense fire. When the end came at 86, it seemed as if his work had long been done. The whole tendency of that period was to regard natural factors, such as soil and climate, as determining civilization. Already the tide has turned. We recognize increasingly that the ideals and actions of men are the supreme cause in human progress. We may thus believe that Carlyle's books will challenge generations of young people to come. Prophet on the Mountain, Carlyle's simple great message is to be real, to hate sham, to take the duty just at hand and do it with all our might, to see that the ideal is here or nowhere. A bit of Carlyle's verse, so simple a child may understand it, so wise the gravest philosopher may well ponder it, carries the heart of his teaching. So here hath been dawning another blue day. Think, wilt thou let it slip useless away? Out of eternity this new day is born. Into eternity at night will return. Behold it aforetime, no eye ever did. So soon it forever from all eyes is hid. Here hath been dawning another blue day. Think, wilt thou let it slip useless away?
Carlyle, a man of letters as prophet and interpreter, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Emerson, Spiritual Leadership in Democracy. Copies of tonight's discussion of Carlyle may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or to the station to which you are listening. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.